This episode of the Intelligent Rebel Squadcast was brought to you by Black America, Inc., a trillion dollar nation. Black America, Inc. is a piece of literature that details and illustrates the socioeconomic solutions that Black Americans can implement in their communities today. Whether it be being captains of our own industries, creating our own political parties, or just learning to strengthen our overall health and wealth, Black America, Inc. is what Black Americans and Americans in general need to get to the next level in 2017 and beyond. For too many years, we have been talking about the problems and not the solutions. For too many years, we have been pointing fingers at each other without talking about the solutions. This is why Black America, Inc. is important. If you're ready to build yourself up, rebuild your community, head on over to Amazon.com and order a copy of Black America, Inc. today.
Yo, yo. What it's like for a nigga like me? Living out his backpack every night, needed a new place to sleep. But this is now, nigga. One's for the money, two for the bitch ass. Three to get ready, cause I feel I finally did it. Four's for the jealous rapper, mad because he finished. Turn that motherfucker to a critic, man. I got so much shit up on my plate, dog.
You. Good morning. Good afternoon and good evening, you intelligent, rebellious people. It is your boy, Doe Dudes, coming live again for another episode of the Intelligent Rebel Squadcast. Now, this is 18-5. I think I'm going to end it here when it comes to black rednecks and white liberals, just because I have a dope health series coming up. You know what I'm saying? Mental health, you know, diet, I mean, you name it, it's gonna be dope, you know what I mean? And I got a bunch of people that I got lined up for the health series, so I think I'm done. I think part three is going to put, you know, a nice cherry on top. In this episode, we just talk about how white liberals have actually affected the black community, you know what I'm saying? We really don't pay attention to that, because a lot of their works come in this, in the guise of aid, so welfare and all these things are gonna be talked about, and it's very, very important information. I hope you guys are ready to be educated again and learn something new about yourself, your community, your people. You know what I'm saying? This is what this entire podcast is about. It's just about telling the truth. It's about getting the truth out there. And one thing that I've noticed is that the truth is entertaining for people who love hearing the real story, whether good or bad. You dig what I'm saying? Like, I was excited to hear that there were black slave owners just because I like hearing the truth, yo. I'm not excited about slavery or whatever, but it just made me feel better that, yo, I know that the story, I got the real story now. You know what I'm saying? So that's how I like my history. I like my stories. I like all of these things to be rooted in truth, backed up by data and accounts from people of that time. And Thomas Sowell, great man, a genius, has given us that. And the fact that this black man is not one of the most popular black people in America is kind of a disgrace, if you ask me. Because this man, with his knowledge, along with all the other greats that we've had, could have definitely pulled us out of the economic bullshit that we have been in for the past 2-3 centuries. You feel me? Like, he had enough information for us to really progress. And he's been doing this since this, you know, 80s, you know what I'm saying, the 70s. So, shout out to Thomas Sowell for all the work that you've done. I really appreciate it. It's changed my life. This episode is going to show y'all exactly why Thomas Sowell is not as popular, because he rooted his solutions in self-accountability, and white liberals do not like when black people are self-sufficient, because white liberals don't have power without them. So I'm not going to talk your ears off. You already know what y'all need to do to get ready for this episode. Roll some, light some, and get ready for the Intelligent Rebel Squad.
Have a gun clapper really trying to make a change. Everybody ain't blessed, my nigga. Yes, my nigga, you're blessed. Take advantage, do your best, my nigga. Don't stress, you was granted everything inside this planet. Anything you imagine, you possess, my nigga. You reject these niggas that neglect your respect for the progress of a baby step, my nigga. Step, step, my nigga. 1, 2, skip, skip, back, back. Look both ways, pull it off the hip. Blast at anybody, say that you can't flip this crack. Into rap music, every other zip is a track. Get used to it, get it off quick. Come back, give back to the city you built. That's that, don't trip. See money, fuck niggas, dog. It ain't nothing but a bunch of fuck niggas, dog. In a minute, everybody go be winning. Put a little faith in it, then recognize that we all.
Bless my nigga, really think about it, could be worse, my nigga. Don't stress, my nigga, yes, my nigga. We all bless, all right. My nigga, stay blessed,
so,
my nigga.
We already see the influence from the redneck culture of white southerners via their English, Irish, and Scottish heritage. Now, this has transmuted and been influenced and been dictated to the black southerners at the time. And as we know, one third of white people were in the South, as opposed to 9/10 of the black population. So this mixture has allowed a culture of just debauchery, just degenerate behavior, backwards thinking, really regressive. And this can't be understated just because it's maybe hard to swallow. It's very important. You have to understand that if you're going to have a prosperous civilization or a prosperous community in America, there are certain cultural things that are attributed to your success. This does not say you have to change who you are, but it would behoove you to change what you are, meaning that you don't have to give up your soul to change your behavior. You can be as real as you want, trail as you want, all of that, but you still have to be able to handle business at home and in your community. And then there will be certain behaviors that will not be tolerated, like crime, like any type of degenerate behavior, expelling the redneck culture out of our communities. That does not mean expelling the people, who you are, but it has to be the release of what you are. And that redneck culture is what you are if you behave that way. So, off top, we have to realize that we cannot be so emotionally attached to a way of life that's never been good for us. And it's been so easy for us to blame external things on that, that it has created and permeated a culture that holds us back. And the number one perpetrator of that perpetuation is the white liberal. And that's why we're here today. Now, racial discrimination in housing became a strict law in Baltimore in 1911. Then it became an overall universal rule amongst the North. You know what I'm saying? This is during the migration, as you remember, of Southern whites and Southern blacks. Now, the migration is important because of the number of people that are coming up north now. You have 90% of all black people coming up from a region to another one and intermingling with their counterparts, as opposed to only 33% of white people doing the same. When you look at that, you have to understand that influence is going to have a more impactful result because of the number of people. We went over how the population tripled and doubled and doubled. So it's easier for white people to maintain their rednecks. It's much easier because it's such a smaller amount. You have more and more prominent people that even in today, you see your mainstream white America making a mockery of that Southern culture. Like I said, with Honey Boo Boo and all these other people, they make money from the mockery of them. And it's easier to push them in the back of television, in the back of cinema, in the back of all of that. Because you have the two-thirds who were doctors, lawyers, and scientists and geniuses and businessmen and all of that. You got all of that for white America, as opposed to that same redneck culture in the black community becoming the majority now. Northern and Midwestern cities where schools have been socially integrated for years, now we're segregated after the migration of black Americans. Blacks in Washington were no longer able to patron theaters, restaurants, hotels, and even their occupation shrink because of this cultural shift. W.E.B. Du Bois, however you say his name, you know, he's been brought up a lot. And I know there's some conflicting interest there because of the whole Booker T. Washington W.E.B. conflict there, you know, that confrontation they had. And because I can look at history from an objective point of view, I can use anybody in history to be able to convey a message. There were some things that I disagreed with W.E.B. on. There were some things that I disagreed about Martin Luther King. There were some things that I disagreed about Marcus Garvey. But because I can look at history from an objective view, because that's how you get the most information, to where you don't have an affinity for one or the other, or at least you can, when you're researching, look at it from an objective view, you get more information, you get more gems there. You dig what I'm saying? Historians record and recite. For the most part, they don't have an affinity for one figure or the other. Now, they may be certain fields of interest that they may get into, and they may have certain personal things that they like or don't like about a person, but when it comes to recording history, it's way better to be able to just put it out there for whoever's opinion that it may reach. So that's where we at now. W.E.B. Du Bois says, "Yet it has everywhere been manifest in the long run that while a part of the Negroes were native-born and trained in the culture of the city, others were immigrants, largely ignorant and unused to city life." So these are the times now, okay? Black people are coming in and they're behaving in a way that is just alien to the people that were already born there. Your New Yorkers, your Pennsylvanians, all of the people that is in, you know, maybe even Chicago, you know, all of these northern Midwestern states that are doing their thing, moving and shaking, they're taken aback by this behavior. Like, we don't act like this. And I want to make it perfectly clear that one culture over the other is not more black as far as America is concerned, because this behavior is both influenced by white people. The redneck culture is influenced by redneck whites, and this northern culture is influenced by northern whites. It's not too many, you know, aboriginal, indigenous, or even African things going on within these black Americans. You know, they're long removed from the continent, and they're long removed from their indigenous lineage. So now, yes, on both ends, this is still influenced by white people. However, when we're talking culturally, when we're talking being able to maneuver in this country, we can clearly see one set of behaviors is better than the other as far as results. So, yeah. In Philadelphia and New York, there were, you know, open claims that the Southern immigration was the thing, one of the main things that was holding them back. Blacks in San Francisco and Northern blacks that were, you know, long settled there, you know, for at least a generation or two, generation and a half, you know, they lived free of the Jim Crow laws, you know, that was going on in the South. You know, that was going on. Bay Area blacks, you know, Oakland and things of that nature, they were observing their, you know, immigrant counterparts. And, you know, they were noted as saying that, you know, they were foreign in the way that they talked and the way that they behaved. You know, they noted people, you know, would eat hamburgers openly on the bus. You know what I'm saying? Like, before Southern, you know, redneck culture came into play here in Black America, this wasn't happening. You dig what I'm saying? Like, none of that was happening. Like, we, if we got burgers or whatever, we waited till we got home and ate at the table, or we ate in the house. You dig what I'm saying? And then, of course, you look at today, you know, that's a thing now. Like, when I get on public transportation, there's people eating whole meals or whatever. Like, that's just a common thing. That's not even, you know, given a second thought. When you're hungry on the go, you're going to eat the food. It's fast food, right? Like, it's pretty much psychologically programmed in our minds to eat whenever. Like, we in the car, we're going to eat. Like, it's just whatever. So, along with that, you have, you know, loud talking, cursing, things of that nature, fighting on the buses. You know, this is a whole new look at how people behave. Yo, like, imagine the culture shock where people who dead ass would never think of doing this type of stuff are now, like, seeing it. And they're not even seeing it from their supposed racial enemy. Because, like, let's not forget that this is still America in the 1800s. So it's still an element of racism there. So they would more so see this type of, you know, brash behavior from white people, but now they're seeing it from their own people. And it's like, yo, what's going on? And like I said, let's not forget the number of people. So let's look at it like this. If we have a bus full of black people, the majority will be your redneck blacks. So you have in a 28-seater, you dig what I'm saying? 20 of them are going to be black rednecks. And only 8 of those will be the, you know, the northern cultured blacks. So this is a whole entire culture shock. Now, socially, racism grew. And I would feel like that would be the only natural thing to happen. Because when we are interacting with people or places that we do not like, we automatically cast judgment on it. If we have a bad time at a restaurant, that restaurant is terrible. That restaurant could be giving A1 service to everybody else, but to you, that restaurant is trash. That's just how prejudice works. That's just how discernment and things that you do and don't like work. You can call it whatever you want, but there have been times that I've listened to a podcast where a white man that grew up in rural Illinois, from his own testimony, from his own experience, the only time he've ever experienced black people was in gangster rap that he listened to, the riots that he saw on the news, and other stereotypical redneck culture things, basically. He didn't say that, but like the degenerate black behavior, that's all he saw. So in his mind, hell no, I don't want to be around these people. And if that makes me racist, then so be it. Because I'm not going to associate with that type of behavior. First and foremost, I don't like when my own race does it. So why would I take on, I got to deal with my own race doing it. So why would I take on another race who is doing this behavior? That's just common sense, yo. That's just common sense. You don't want, if you're a black person, you don't want a bunch of rowdy Mexicans coming in your area. If you are living good, everybody doing what they supposed to be doing, everybody got a job, ain't nobody out there committing crimes, your neighborhood is clean, and you have a bunch of Asians that come in your neighborhood and start dirtying it up, bringing drugs and crime in your neighborhood, you're going to be like, I don't want these Asians here. And then imagine having these same people tell you that you're racist against them based upon you not letting them do whatever the hell they want in your community. Naturally, you're going to be deemed a racist. And then after a while, a generation or two, plus mixed in with the cultural things where people actually do hate black people, you're going to have mad generations of people be considered racist in the news and all of this other stuff. So that's just what happens. You can't deny triggers. You can't deny things that make things happen. It's cause and effect. That's just how it goes. Northern blacks would say that, you know, they would perceive Southern blacks like they had a chip on their shoulder. And you see that today as well. From 1940 to 1960, black households that were below the poverty line decreased from 87% to 47%. That's huge. That means black people in only 20 years' time are doing their thing, yo. They're getting it together. Yeah, the migration happened, you know, 50 years ago or whatever. We're making do, we're doing what we can do as far as, you know, giving our Southern blacks culture and things like that, jobs, and they're meshing, they're getting into it, you know, they're trying to assimilate as much as they can. You still have your criminals and things of that nature going on, but we're making it work for the most part. Things are happening. We're moving up. We're dropping poverty lines. You feel what I'm saying? Like, we are coming up from 1936 to 1959. Black income in various trades doubled in respect to whites during that same time. So this is what I'm saying. Like, black ingenuity, black work ethic, black everything, as far as our will to get things done, these are the things that we need to be highlighting. If we're able to do this in 1936, there's no way that we can't do this in 2017. Now, in 1948, President Truman, he ran on a campaign of civil rights. Dig what I'm saying? And because he won, you know, the suggestion is that, you know, the majority of people were with it. Because for the most part, at least what we want to focus on in certain circles, we see that black people are getting it together. So Truman, being a politician, like, let's not forget that he's a politician, spoke on civil rights and things of that nature. Now, you have plenty of people telling him, like, yo, you're going to ruin your campaign doing this. You're going to lose everybody if you do this. But he went ahead and did it, and he won. So that just suggests that even from however you want to look at it in the political spectrums of today, you know, as far as politicians saying stuff for people to like and get votes and all of that other stuff. But because this president won, for whatever reason, that campaign or that stance he took on civil rights still resonated with enough people. And, you know, that goes into the black vote and all of these other things. So you have overall black people doing their thing. Why we don't talk about this ever in black history, I will not know. I never learned this stuff in school. I never learned about anybody other than activists, preachers, and martyrs, pretty much. You dig what I'm saying? I didn't hear about this. So, in this era, yo, we got black things happening. Like, you know what I'm saying? Our people are building. And then comes the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And then the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Let's dig into that for a little bit. Now, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act did a lot for black Americans. I don't want to just openly disrespect the bill like it, you know, didn't do anything. You dig what I'm saying? What it did, I'm sure, just because I know how emotional people are, especially Americans, when you have legislation that appears or at least shows to be beneficial or in your favor, you're going to feel good about it. So the overall happiness feeling, you dig what I'm saying? I gotta give it that. Also, according to Thomas Sowell, it did a lot for racial barriers in elected officials, like blacks being elected to office. And of course, like, this is fresh off of, you know, segregation, and now things are being desegregated, you know, all of the, you know, Ruby Bridges of the world, all of the, you know, young men and women, old men and women who suffered, you know, all of those attacks in the street, and all of these segregated crimes, and, you know, all of these things. Now we have everybody just in high spirits and all of that about it. People are now being more elected into office. And that's all well and good, yo. Salute to that era, you know? Salute to that being passed. However, economically, it didn't do anything for us. As a matter of fact, decades prior, as I told y'all, poverty was getting chopped down in the community. But even though these two bills passed in our favor, no economic growth came from it. It kept at the same pace, if anything. So when we know the importance of economics in this country, what happened when all of these bills were passed in our community? What happened? How was it that we got the right to vote, but then our communities didn't grow? I got an answer for you. Two words: white liberals. Now, white liberals come in many forms. Many forms. In 2017, we see them all over. Okay? They run, I don't want to say everything, but they own a huge amount. And they come in the roles of intellectuals, politicians, of course, celebrities, judges, and teachers. When you hear those examples, think of the influence that all of those titles have on the American populace, individually and as a collective. So let's just say an intellectual, a politician, a celebrity, a judge, and a teacher come together for a movement, for a reason to protest, for anything that would have anything to do with the way people behave. And I want you to think how many times you have seen an intellectual, a politician, a celebrity, a judge, or a teacher come together for something. Maybe a march, maybe a speech, maybe a documentary, maybe an interview, maybe a panel discussion. So these white liberals are all around you. They're your professors in your schools. A lot of you sociology majors, I'm sure. A lot of your teachers, if not all of your teachers, are white liberals. If I'm not mistaken, 95% of colleges and universities are liberal, meaning that there is no room for discussion of conservative views, and there's no room for discussion for opposing liberal views. This is what's taking place, by and large, on our college campuses, where our brightest young men and women are being cultivated at a very impressionable age. This is the knowledge that these kids get to where they can actually be confident and sometimes even arrogant in their presentation of what they learned. So when you have a bunch of liberals teaching your 17, 18, 19-year-old child about racism, oppression, slavery, feel bad about yourself, feel bad about your skin tone, feel bad for your ancestors, feel bad, and then deliver it in a scholarly way from an authoritative figure, that black child is going to put so much value into that teacher's words. So when they are 26, 27, 28, 29, they're like, no, I learned. They're not going to say I learned, but they'll say I study, I research, I know how shitty my race is. I know how bad I should feel about myself. I know how big of a victim I am. And I have this degree to prove it. This is then given to their children. This is then transmuted into their children's friends, their friends as adults. And then this culture is now being perpetuated on a scholastic level. So now, black intellectuals feel bad about themselves. They go in deeper and deeper into these social issues, less and less in finance, business, STEM, healthcare. Less about that, more about being a social worker, more about being a sociologist, more about being a liberal arts major. These things are now being encouraged in the community because your favorite celebrity is saying it, your favorite politician is saying it, Your favorite teacher is saying it. Even your parent is even telling you this stuff. Now, that's the people that are able to go to college and, you know, able to want to look at their oppression from a scholastic level. How do we push this victim narrative to poor blacks? How can we make the poor blacks feel the same way these intellectual blacks feel about themselves in a way that we can connect with them? Because you can't tell a poor black person any studies or anything from a scholastic level. You have to meet them at their level, their income level, their IQ level. And here comes the war on poverty, the welfare state. The war on poverty in the welfare state has to be the most diabolical scheme from the white liberal. It totally destabilized our families, destroyed our communities, brought drugs and guns into it, out of wedlock babies, in the sense of long-term commitment, if you remember from what I said in the previous episode. It developed and nurtured the worst qualities of Black American life and made it so prevalent in the culture that people are proud of it. Now, Walter E. Williams is an economist. He did a documentary, I want to say in the late 70s or the 80s, called Good Intentions. And the documentary was about the welfare state and what it actually did for the community versus what it was intended, quote unquote, for it to do. One of the first elements that I learned about in this documentary was minimum wage. Now, as somebody who was born in 1989, you know, which is really 1990 because I'm born so late in 89, I didn't know anything other than minimum wage, especially when I became of age to get a job. So I only knew minimum wage. But apparently, according to Walter E. Williams, the introduction of the minimum wage worker was a striking blow to the Black American economy, the Black American community overall. Because what that meant is that children who were 14, 15, you know, of that age, who would normally get a job at like a hardware store, a grocery store, or, you know, a corner bodega, something like that, they would usually work for like a dollar an hour because of the experience that they had or lack thereof. Like, you're not going to pay a kid the same amount you would a young man that's 21 who has experience in running the register or keeping books or anything like that. You would pay that young man more than you would pay the teenager, clearly, because of the quality of work and the level of experience. So these teenagers would work for a dollar an hour and they would get the first job. And the first job is very important in American culture. You know, this gives these young men and women, you know, these children, the ability to show some work for themselves. That after they go to school all day, you know, do their homework, do a, you know, 4-hour, 5-hour shift, you know, at the local grocery store or whatever, make a little money for themselves. And, you know, now you're starting to begin your process of living the American dream. You can save money now. You can, you know, buy sneakers if you want them. You can go to the arcade. You can do kid stuff and you can afford it on your own from your own merit. You feel good. You feel accomplished. You feel like you can actually make something of yourself. So these first jobs are extremely important for Black youth. And the minimum wage requirement took away a lot of jobs. Walter Williams even interviewed a store owner and asked him, you know, don't you need some more help going on around here? He was like, you know, I would love to hire more kids, but now that the minimum wage is $4, four times as much, I got to pay each kid $4? They only going to be here for 4 hours. I just need them to pick up where I'm slacking at, and that way I can run my business. I can get more money because I have people to process more customers, and I can deal with other things like inventory, ordering new things because I can afford them now. Things are happening in my business. I just can't afford to be given four kids $4 each for 4 hours of work. That's a lot of money. So now I'm stuck with, instead of having four kids for $1 each, I gotta pay one kid $4. That meant black unemployment rose so much. That means black unemployment skyrockets. Now kids who would normally be at the corner store or whatever working, they outside playing basketball, or they outside with the riffraff. They outside with the thugs. They outside with people that they're not supposed to be associating with. And as we know, it's easy to corrupt a young mind. That's why it's easy for a young kid to be trained at a good job and give them great work ethics that they can take on to in adulthood. So now we have a bunch of kids out in the street, idle time, parents are at work. So now we got, you know, a higher rate of crime coming on. Another element of the welfare state was housing. And the way that housing worked was you have to basically be in dire straits on a family structure level to get this assistance. Meaning that you can't be poor with a man in the house. You can only be poor if you're single and if you have a child. But if it's just you and your man in a house and y'all need some assistance, don't come here. So we now see a rise of young women, 16, 15, 17, 18, having children to be able to afford a lifestyle that they want. So now, like I said, less work is more crime. So now we're seeing more crime in the streets. Imagine for 1 second, Walter Williams says this in the documentary, if you're a 16-year-old girl walking through your neighborhood, and all of the young men are out there either playing ball, doing whatever, crimes, and, you know, all of that at home, things are, you know, full of turmoil between your mother and your father, or your mother and your mother's boyfriend or whatever, and you just want to just live on your own. You just want to be able to escape this. You want to be able to live on your own merits in some way. And then you go on down to the office. You go down there and get a social worker and all of that, and they tell you, one of the first things they ask you is, do you have any children? The 17-year-old, the 16-year-old says, no, I just want to be able to, you know, live good. I just want to be able to do what I want to do because it's just not safe for me at the house or whatever. And the caseworker tells her that right now, we're only looking for single mothers because that's who we're giving preferential treatment to here. So she goes home and she's living in that turmoil or whatever. And she may have a boyfriend or whatever. So she has a kid. Now she's 18 with a kid, 17 with a kid. She goes down to the office. She applies for the housing and all of that. And they ask her, the father's not in the child's life, is he? She says, yeah. That's his child. And they like, well, we actually give preferential treatment to young women who are living on their own. They're doing things on their own to raise their children. You know, a lot of relationships end because of babies. And, you know, a lot of people start arguing and people start, you know, breaking up because of babies. You know, babies are a big stress, and, you know, we're here to help. We're trying to give you guys, you know, housing and food and money and all of this stuff. We just know how hard it is. And, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it's because you guys are not really meant for each other. So we can't help you today, but, you know, if we can help you in the future, let us know. So she goes home frustrated because she still can't get her benefits, and she's living at her mother's house, and you know, all of this stuff. Her mother's giving her grief and all of this stuff. And, you know, she's stressed at school and she's stressed with her boyfriend and all that other stuff. And they break up. It's been, you know, a heartbreaking thing. She's stressed out. The baby's stressed out. Things are going bad. She goes back down to that office. And they say, oh, wow, your life is in shambles. We have to give you a house now. And then, boom, you are now comforted by the same system that persuaded you to totally destroy your young adulthood. This is what the welfare state did. Black men that were now pushed out and walked out of the household were deadbeat dads. Made it much harder for them to see their children because women in the back of their mind knew the incentive of the life that they were living. And if the child and the father ever got too close, those incentives would go away. That's a fact. If you have something going good, you're not going to mess it up. That's just how it goes. So now, and this is before cell phones, this is only phone calls and pull-ups. So if he's on the other side of town, he's only calling. He's not pulling up. If he's close enough, he's pulling up. He's not calling. However it may go, the relationship must stay tattered. It must stay some type of disconnected to be able to keep getting these benefits. That's just the guidelines of the benefits. The mother could dead ass be torn and thinking like, I'm going to lose my house. I'm going to lose my whatever assistance I'm getting if they get closer. But I want my child to be in his father's life or her father's life. I would have to believe that was a turmoil that was going on. So this is what's going on in the welfare state. Now, fathers, according to Walter E. Williams, will more than likely start pursuing things on their own endeavors. Getting jobs for themselves, trying to just make a living for themselves and all of that. On the single man set. And it's often deals with having another woman come in his life. And potentially having another child in some of the same situations as the previous child. We see that today as well. So as the black man is doing his best to climb the ladder, so to speak, he's still making unwise sexual decisions. Creating bigger and bigger incentives for these women to go on public assistance. With the degenerate behavior from the criminals, you had lax police enforcement, where you can imagine cops just watching crime happen, a street brawl, a stabbing, a robbing, just watching them because crime is running rampant. Ain't nobody got jobs. So it's like you and your partner in a police car, are you going to shut down a 20 people brawl in the middle of the street by yourselves? No, you can get yourself killed. Remember what police officers were dealing with in the 70s and 80s as far as guns and equipment and artillery. So you have all of these things happening to where cops are just like, yo, man, I'm not getting involved. And if we do, we come in brute force. That's the only time we're dealing with these people. Either we shooting, beating them, or something like that because they're wild animals out here. That's how they're looking at them. So they falling back. Then when cops did do something, they were criticized by it from the white liberal. White liberals hate the police because it pushes their agenda. White liberals want us to hate the police. They cause this friction with the welfare state. They cause this friction with the bad education. They cause this friction between black people and the police. They heighten it. They exacerbate it. And then when cops react to it, when blacks react to it, the cops are doing too much. If the cops don't do enough, then they're not caring about the neighborhood. They don't care. So this social spin is to make it that no matter what the police do, they're wrong. Then influencing the black masses to think that they don't need policing and that the crime, the debauchery, the degenerate behavior is just a product of who you guys are. And all we have to do is keep facilitating ways for you to kill yourselves, and we'll keep profiting off your death. We'll keep profiting off of your despair. We'll keep profiting off of the single mothers, the single fathers, the children on Ritalin, the children on, you know, all of these drugs to quote unquote pay attention in school. They'll keep profiting from this. And this is not just being done to black people, but as we know, white liberals have influenced the black masses incredibly, incredibly, to the point you have a view of history to where you have only seen the offense of one side and not your own, even though you live directly next to them, because the white liberal has given your neighbor an excuse to do the shit that he or she does. White liberals provided a blanket excuse for the behavior. It's racism. It's the effects of slavery. This is what you white racist people have done to them. And we must save them. And we must allow them to do this, because this is just expression. They're just expressing themselves. This is just the results of their great, great, great grandmother being enslaved. This is what they're saying. You know, they blamed others. They allow black people to blame others for their shortcomings. So, for instance, tests. Tests are huge. Everybody, you know, wants to believe that tests are universally racist and to the advantage of the white man or the white woman. Now, listen, whatever test that you give somebody, even if you skew it to make sure that a certain demographic doesn't passes, there's still a right answer to those questions. So that means you have the ability to pass that test. Outside of these people lying on your results, if you pass that test, you pass that test. It could have been totally skewed, but it's either a right answer or a wrong answer. And if you get the right answer, you pass the test. So, with that, when you talk about this white supremacist test system, right? This is what the white liberals are saying is happening. They don't explain how Asian children pass at higher rates than whites. And they also don't explain how black immigrants pass this test more than whites. So how can the test be racist if white people can lose? You dig what I'm saying? See, everybody looks at this from a one-sided thing, like I've been saying. You say that it's against blacks, but you don't acknowledge or at least follow through with your logic saying that it's for whites. That would mean, regardless of how smart or dumb a white person is or isn't, they were going to pass that test because of whiteness. But as we can see with the test scores of soldiers, that this is not the case. And then, you know, that travels into the workplace. So if a black lawyer doesn't get promoted at the same rate or whatever as a white person or the white people in the firm, because they like to do that too, to where they put a scenario where it's only like two black professionals in a space of a majority of white, and then calculate the frequency of promotion from white and black employees. And that's ridiculous, because there's going to be more promotion among whites because it's more whites, period. You know, these statistics are dead ass used to keep you in a certain position, yo. Like, you can't compare two apples to 100 apples. You can't. Even if they're all apples or whatever, it's just not gonna happen. The 100 apples are always going to be more significant in the test. So, if only one apple rots from the 100, that's 1%. You know what I'm saying? That's only one apple out of 100. But if one apple dies from the bunch of two, that's half of its population. So you have to understand statistics in that same way, to where you have to make it relative to the number of people. So white liberals told black people that weren't getting promoted as much as the tens of more white people that was going in the office, that it meant it was racism and not the fact that their quality of work did not match or exceed the expectations. This is not totally to, you know, get people off the hook for discrimination, but when it comes to blatant discrimination, you can prove that in court. See, it's one thing to tweet about racism and all of that oppression shit, you know what I'm saying? But ask these people if they can prove what they're saying in court and actually get a judgment in their favor. For real. See if you can prove the racism that people claim people are doing in court. Because racism in the workplace is illegal. Businesses fail because of racism. You don't understand, like, the social stigma that white people have when it comes to being called a racist. Like, I don't think y'all really know. Like, when you talk to white people, yo, and you just having a conversation with them, and it's out of nowhere, you call them a racist, yo, they be feeling bad as hell, yo. Now, I'm going to tell you right now from the statistics that I read that it said 89% of white people were indifferent to racial issues going on in America. Then, when I did episode 15 with Chris, they said that it was a serious problem. Now, I would have to say that's just from media manipulation and all of that other stuff. But dead ass, yo, that's the reason white liberals call these conservative whites and other whites that don't agree with them racist all the time. Like, you've noticed, like, when it comes to being called a racist from a white person, it's always on the behalf of some other race. It's never within, like, black people being racist to them or Asians being racist to them or whatever. White liberals do not care about white issues whatsoever. Like, I've noticed that about them. And it's like they always calling out racism amongst their race all of the time. And I'm like, yo, what is your problem, yo? Like, what is with you always, like, that self-hate shit comes from white liberals, yo. White liberals hate being white. So they want to make sure that they separate themselves from anything that has anything to do with white people in a negative light, yo. For real. Now, when it comes to white liberals, though, they promote the degenerate behavior on our side, the black side, and then shame the people on their side for reacting to the shit that they're promoting on our side. And that way, they stand in the middle and can condemn and praise both groups intermittently. It doesn't even matter, because you'll then have white liberals go on and erase black women from their narratives. They'll go on and to erase certain black men out of their narratives, like straight black men out of their narratives. Like, they can do, they can make black straight men the enemy now, which is what they're doing. And they're doing that same thing on their side. This manipulative shit that these white liberals be doing go deeper than what y'all really think it is, yo. It was another instance. So, back in like the 80s and 70s, white cab drivers were reported to skip black men after a certain time of night because they were in fear of their lives because niggas did wild shit after dark, because that's what criminals do. You know, and I'm really getting tired of people just throwing racism at everything. And it comes from this white liberal people. If you, all right, I'll give you a perfect example. When I was living in North Carolina, I was going to high school out there, and my white southern classmates came to school in camo gear, in hunting gear, every day. They had pickup trucks with shotgun racks, sometimes with shotguns on them. Every day in a public school, every day. And I stayed the clear fuck away from them because they look like they shoot people or they shoot shit. I befriended one of them to understand, because I always have to do that. But by and large, I stayed away from them. And you know what's so wild is that they were able to wear all of that shit, have a shotgun on the back of their truck. But as soon as a black kid was sagging their pants or wore fitted or whatever in the hallway, like me, I was reprimanded for it immediately. I'm like, yo, you have whole gunmen in my chemistry class. What are you talking about? Like, this is crazy. So what I'm saying is, I'm not picking up the nigga that's dangerous on the street, and I'm not picking up the huntsman who wants to look like he's fucking Duck Dynasty in my cab either. White liberals call these white cab drivers racist. Then, of course, because white liberals are the most hypocritical people in this country, they had nothing to say for the black cab drivers who did the same thing to the same niggas after dark. Because they want to go home at the end of the night and not die or not have to be stiffed for the fare. These are realities. These are realities of this country. We need to stop ignoring them. And white liberals is the reason why we ignore them. So, closing out, yo. We gotta wake up. I thought I was gonna do a fourth episode, and I may. But for right now, I think we have to really understand what we're dealing with when it comes to these white liberals, yo. And what it really means to the community. As you can see, before these white liberals came into play, we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. Even crime was dramatically dropping. And the same time that poverty was dropping, of course crime was going to follow. Less and less black men and women were getting locked up. More and more people were getting married. Black people were getting married more than white people in a lot of instances. Our lives were great when we would worry about ourselves. Then these white liberals came into play and told us to care about all of their issues. Women's issues, LGBTQ issues, disabled issues. All of these issues that really never plagued our communities whatsoever. We were made to care about these things. White feminists appropriated black women. I said that before. These white liberal women revered our black women because of how strong, forthcoming, honest, transparent, and just overall brilliant our black women were, and appropriated that behavior and stole our swag, told these black women that we were the problem, that we needed to worry about women's issues. Now, I want to tell you, and I want to make it perfectly clear, that yes, there are definite sexist elements in the black community. Every bad thing that you can think of, there's elements of it in the black community. But when we're talking about overall, black men and women were getting married and loving each other and forming families and building their communities at higher rates than a lot of people in this country way before these white savior, white liberal, white people came into our communities and told us what we should care about. And if history has told us anything, yo, is that we should not take heed to the words of these people because they poison our communities every time they come through. You think these people are for you. You think these people have your best interests at heart, but every time they make a move on our behalf, it's detrimental. And every time they make us make a move on their behalf, it's profitable for them. So before they get arrested and beat by the police in a protest, they will send you out there. They sent you out there for 4 or 5 years straight before they even had the balls to muster up a women's march where it was mostly white women. And I was glad my people wasn't really involved in that. Because we need to separate ourselves from these people because they've never had our interests at heart, yo. They want you to totally be androgynous out here. They don't want you to accept your masculinity. They don't want you to accept your femininity unless it's something that they dictated to be. I've seen these people, yo, in real life. It's not something I'm just seeing on the internet. I've seen these people. I've talked to them. They dead ass think of black people like children, like they need to save us, like they need to talk to us like we're babies. I've seen them straight up and down, B. Like, y'all gotta understand, like, yo, these people not playing with us. They playing us. So I hope you understand just how detrimental these white liberals are, and you look at history from a different point of view now. Thomas Sowell gave us gems in his book, and he got way more gems. I'm just ending it here because I want you guys to read the book, and I got more content to give out on my half episodes. But for real, y'all, wake up out here, yo. Wake up.
Somebody should have told me it would be like this, be like this, be like this. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Yeah. Life is a balance. You lose your grip, you can slip into an abyss. No doubt, you see these niggas tripping. Ego in charge of every move, he's a star. And we can't look away due to the days that he caught our hearts. He's falling apart, but we deny it. Justifying a half-assed shit he dropped, we always buy it. When he tell us he a genius, but it's clearer lately. It's been hard for him to look into the mirror lately. There was a time when this nigga was my hero, maybe. That's the reason why his fall from grace is hard to take. Cause I believed him when he said his shit was pure, ain't he? The type of nigga swear he real, but all around us fake.
Yeah, so that was episode 18.5, man. And it's the end, yo. That is the end of the Black Rednecks and White Liberals. I thought I was gonna go for a fourth one. I was thinking over it. I'm just like, nah, man. Bottom line, we need to, first of all, first and foremost, worry about our communities. First and foremost, worry about our people. And then once we have our society and our infrastructure together, then we can start doing business with other people and worrying about social issues with other people and other races. Right now, yo, we have allowed these white liberals to dictate our woes, our focus, our, you know, what's important to us and our community. We just can no longer let that happen. Now that we are in the information age where we have the world at our fingertips, we can no longer be ignorant to what they have been doing to us for all of this time. So I hope everybody has, you know, learned something here, black or white. You know what I'm saying? Everybody says that they want to find that common ground. Nobody wants racism and all of that other stuff. Well, we have to deal with the fact that there was black people who made the conscious decision to do bad things. And then we also have to do the same thing to these white people in all facets. And that way, once everybody is accountable for the bullshit that everybody has done, we can move forward. I'm going to call it, man. No one race did more to each other or did more to themselves than the other, yo. There were things that black people have done that were almost irreversible. There were things that white liberals have done to their race that was almost irreversible. So we just have to understand the truth of the situation, that we have always had our destiny in our hand, no matter how dire the situation is, man. And that's just how humans give it up, yo. Right now, think about it. All of the time when we talk about, oh, if I was a slave, they would have killed me. Exactly. Exactly. There were people who thought like that and did die, yo. And there were other people who submitted. There's other people who capitalized on it. There's so many different things, you know what I'm saying? So just keep that in mind when you listen to history and you're moving forward out here, man. And as always, stay intelligent and stay rebellious.
Pennies, I wanna give hope like the fountains you throw pennies in. Hit the star, take your disc, make your wish. This is dedicated to the ones that listen to me on some faithful shit. I'm on some thankful shit, but the real God is in you, not the music you copping. I hear my old shit and know I can top it. False prophets. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Be like this. Be like this. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Be like this. False prophets. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Be like this. Be like this. Somebody should have told me it would be like this.
He said it.